Welcome to Epilogue, where I tell you folktales and legends and fabricate my own counterpart from those root yarns. I am that campfire tale you heard as a child that still gives you chills, but you can call me Yuzikaba. Theater is an undying tradition that has shaped filmed entertainment into what it is today. For most, it is the first introduction to the power and privilege of performance. In ancient times, theater was how history was kept alive, how gods were made great, and how warnings were passed down to generations untold. But sometimes, it isn't the stories that warn us away from indecency. Sometimes, it's the theater itself. Almost all of the theaters on Broadway can boast of ghostly activity on those storied stages, but one ghost outshines them all. David Belasco, the Bishop of Broadway. He opened the Belasco Theater, formerly the Stuyvesant Theater, in 1907, a masterpiece of architecture from George Keister, who designed the space to evoke a temple, including Tiffany chandeliers and ceilings, as well as murals by renowned Ashcan School artist Everett Shin on the walls. This theater, the sixth oldest still operating on Broadway, was declared a national landmark in 1987, and these elements were lovingly restored or taken to various museums to continue being admired by American audiences. Belasco built himself a 10-room penthouse duplex above the theater, continuing his ecclesiastical motif with a living room designed like a Gothic church, complete with a stained glass dome and a telephone booth he would use as a confessional at his parties. And those parties were well-loved and well-attended, for Belasco was a giant on Broadway. He was an actor, a writer, a manager, a producer, a dramatist, and a director. He was considered a man of the century, and innovated some of the technology that would become the basis for the light boards still used in theaters today. David Belasco died at 77 in 1931 after a long battle with illness, but he never left the theater he so loved. Fortunately, Belasco's ghost is little more than a lovable nuisance. People have reported seeing a priest in the private box during rehearsals and on opening night, where if the performance went well, he would shake people's hands backstage. But if it didn't, Belasco would moan and ransack the dressing rooms, and make sure his review was the first that the actors knew. They reported seeing him in the mirror while they were in the makeup chair, or passing in the hallway on their way to the stage. Even the parties never ceased, for there have been multiple reports of people hearing the disused elevator going up to his penthouse, followed by the sounds of shuffling feet, muffled laughter, and jazz above them. But whenever they opened the penthouse to scatter the trespassers, it was empty. A temple of dust, undisturbed by the echoes of revelry. But David Belasco is not alone in his haunting. He's joined by a much different apparition. She's called the Blue Lady, and when she appears on the steps leading up to the stage, she does so surrounded by an aura that has been described as an icy blue mist. She's not as vocal and as active as Belasco is, but she certainly has made her presence known throughout the years. Unlike Belasco, the Blue Lady was not a lauded practitioner of the theatrical arts, but rather she was likely a rising starlet who fell down the elevator shaft that leads up to the penthouse. David Belasco and the Blue Lady have seen it all, including both Marlon Brando and Al Pacino's theatrical debuts in 1946 and 1969, respectively. Though there have been reports of them in recent years, they remained backstage, so to speak, for the years following the 1971 production of O Calcutta, which featured nudity. The offense has since worn off, with actors in more recent productions still celebrating Belasco's birthday with a cake and referencing the ghost in their production's opening safety brief. Every night, the crew still shouts, "Good night, Mr. Belasco," into the empty theater before shutting off the lights, though perhaps that theater will never be empty for as long as it stands. And now for our epilogue. Not every dramatist in New York City makes it to Broadway. In fact, most don't. Angela de Musa is one of the many creatives that make up the lifeblood of the city, an aging hopeful with dreams taller than the Empire State Building. In spite of her efforts, monumental as they were, the city is not as kind to artists as it once was. She was never able to do more than self-produce a couple of black box flops or help her friends accomplish their own basement revelries. Her big break came when she was awarded the prestigious Morgan Playwriting Fellowship. The program had been inactive for years, but it was one of the most sought-after fellowships the moment it opened. The Morgan Fellowship's grant allowed Angela to hire actors and crew, rent all the equipment she could need, and cover transportation upstate to produce Angela's original play. Angela was thrilled. Before the ink had even dried on the contracts, Angela and her team were on her way upstate to the old Morgan Theater. In spite of the decay of neglect, the theater was beautiful. Its grand proscenium drew the eye up to a ceiling that was once painted with a golden mural of twin gods drawing astrological chariots around a dusty chandelier. There were cracked moldings on the walls that went right down to the floor, where the torn red velvet of the seats almost matched that of the sweeping moth-eaten curtain that covered the stage. Angela pulled back that curtain to reveal a backstage that looked like it had been fled in a hurry. Trash, pieces of old sets, long disused props, and pages from a past production littered the dark corners off stage. And dark they were, for none of the lights in the grid above had any power. Most of the light fixtures were rusted beyond hope, and some of them didn't even have bulbs. Except for the ghost light, which was already on when they walked in. A ghost light, also called an equity light, is a single bulb on a stand that is left on when all the other lights are shut off to ensure the safety of the cast and crew as they exit the theater. Angela wasn't sure who had turned it on for their arrival, but surely it couldn't have been on all those years when the theater was closed. Either way, the shining beacon spurred her on, and while the crew set about working their technical magic, Angela started to clear away the rubble of production's past. When 10 o'clock rolled around, the crew was released according to their union contracts, but Angela stayed behind to prepare the space for the next day's rehearsal. The ghost light shone all the while, a white light that comforted Angela a great deal that late at night. As she was sewing the torn velvet seats, the ghost light changed. It turned blue. It was a nice blue. Pale blue, like eyes. Angela looked up and jumped, startled by the change. But she also found it delightful. "How marvelous," she said. "I've never seen that happen at any other theater." The ghost light seemed to pulse in response, then stopped. Angela assumed that was some sort of interruption to the power flow and kept right on chatting. "I just don't understand it. This little light works fine, but the electricians were huffing and puffing over the power and wires all day. I just don't know why they're in such a foul mood." The light pulsed again. In Angela's mind, the mind of a creative, it almost matched the rhythm of laughter. Even she could tell that was a far-fetched thought, and decided it must be exhaustion setting in. She left her work for the night, returned the next day, excited to fill the space with drama and passion. And that is precisely what she and her cast did. While the crew continued their work above them, Angela's company put her masterpiece on its feet. Angela had previously devised a feminist piece in a workshop with her friends, a work that was billed as an anthology of American horrors, fresh takes on the illnesses of the patriarchy, capitalism, environmental decay, sexism, all through the perspective of discarded birth control packaging. Angela envisioned the work shocking the audience into taking action by employing every legal obscenity she could think of on the stage. Just when she was choreographing a particularly lewd scene, something creaked above her, and one of the rented lights came crashing down, right where Angela had been standing a moment before. The actors screamed and scattered, away from the twisted metal and the broken glass. Angela looked up to see which of the electricians had dropped the light, but there was no one nearby. Rehearsal was halted as the crew went to check the bolts on all the remaining fixtures in the air, but they were all securely fastened, as they insisted the fallen light had been. Though they had no reason to suspect any other mishaps would occur, something in the air had changed, and the space no longer felt safe for creation. When they left that evening, Angela returned the ghost light to the center of the stage and decided to stay behind to continue the cosmetic efforts to the theater. The master electrician found her and apologized again for what had happened, but Angela was not in the business of holding grudges, so she forgave him immediately, and even threw in a little quip about how the marvelous color-changing ghost light could replace the fixture if needed. He looked at her strangely, then squinted at the white light. "But miss," he said, "that type of bulb doesn't have the ability to change color." Angela laughed, thinking it to be some sort of joke she didn't understand. He left, and she began repainting the walls. Sure enough, the ghost light changed color again. It snapped into a deep red, fast enough to make Angela jump. "See?" she said to herself. I knew he was kidding. Angela carried on painting, taking no notice that the light made strange shadows, as if the beam was interrupted by a darkness whose source was also the ghost light. The shadows moved and flickered like firelight. When they brushed over the wall Angela had been painting, she watched them curiously, searching her limited technical knowledge for a way of rationalizing the shadows. They seemed to make strange shapes, swirling in and out of existence, some eldritch dance she could swear she'd seen before. Then it dawned on her with a sinking horror that she was watching her play rehearsals played out in those bloody shadows. But it was a grotesque mockery of what she'd done, Each shocking act made downright monstrous the vindictive red light. Terrified, Angela ran to the back of the theater and tried the door, but it was locked. She had the key, of course, but it no longer fit the lock. The shadows flickered faster and advanced through the audience. Just when they were about to wash over her, they dissipated into that pretty blue light, which took the nightmares with it as it illuminated the empty theater. She tried the door again, and it popped open, as if it had never been locked at all. Angela turned back to the theater and thanked the blue light. She knew it was a silly gesture, but somehow it felt right. The next day, the previous day's scare had worn off and the actors were refreshed and ready. But Angela was not. As Angela watched the run, those horrible shadows played across her mind, filling her vision with red and making her frightened of her own drama. It was no longer fun and exciting to shock her audience. In fact, sitting in the front row of the theater, she felt her eyes fill with tears and her throat fill with bile. She stopped the rehearsal and began revising the scenes, promising the actors to take this drama more seriously and giving it the respect it was due. The actors were outraged. Not only had they rehearsed the original version, they were excited about it. They believed in it. And they wanted a director who would believe in it too. As the argument crescendoed, the front door opened and the head of the fellowship, Peggy Morgan, walked into the auditorium. Peggy asked Angela for updates about the progress of the show and the condition of the theater, and Angela confessed to certain creative disagreements and technical difficulties. Fortunately, Peggy had been in the business long enough to know that was to be expected. Then Peggy made a little quip about the ghosts and turned to go. "What do you mean by that?" Angela asked. "Only that sometimes the ghosts like to meet the cast, is all. Before the theater closed, there were stories." "I won't bore you with them." Angela begged her to do just that, and Peggy obliged. The Morgan Theater was founded in 1942 by Scarlett and Amelia Morgan, a playwright and an actress who were sisters. Scarlett wrote her plays under a male pseudonym, thinking it would give her an advantage when being considered for production. But in that time, the world was inhaling, and there was no compassion to be spared for the theater. Amelia solved the issue of finances by marrying Stuart Paunch, a wealthy man who had made his fortune in imports and exports. He sponsored their theater and opened their productions, but Stuart was a conservative gentleman, more so than he let on in his courtship in Amelia. As Scarlett's plays grew more radical in their support of civil liberties, Stuart began implementing restrictions and threatened to cut funds unless the plays were censored to his liking. Scarlett loathed Stuart and his restrictions, and on the night she refused to comply, Stuart strangled her to death. Amelia was too late to stop him. She could only catch Scarlett's body as it fell. Stuart insisted that Amelia leave her and go on. The show was starting, and he had already funded that performance. Amelia began this particular work by entering with a heavy candelabra. Before she went on that night, she bludgeoned Stuart to death with the candelabra and played the whole show with his blood dripping from her fingertips. Amelia left the theater to their youngest sister, Molly, before fleeing into the night, never to return. The theater closed when Molly became too old to care for it, and her daughter Peggy reopened it with this fellowship. Angela's submission reminded Peggy of something her Aunt Scarlett might have written, so Peggy awarded her the honor of carrying on the theater's legacy. Peggy evinced her ghost story by plucking an old photograph off the back wall, where a row of dusty pictures had been hanging all along. It was a color photograph from the 1950s of Stuart Paunch and the Morgan sisters. Stuart's fine suit sported a blood-red pocket square, and Scarlett wore a beautiful sapphire dress, a pale blue garment that made her brilliant eyes all the more striking. Angela squinted at the photograph, recognizing where she had seen these colors. The ghost light had taken on these shades to comfort and chastise. She nearly dropped the photograph in shock. Shaking, Angela thanked Peggy again for this opportunity and dismissed the actors for the day. That night, she sent a mass email from her hotel room, telling the cast that they would be rehearsing the original production of the show in an alternate space until the end of the week. The cast took their unhappy victory and ran with it. Her vision was nearly restored to its former glory, every bit as salacious as Angela hoped it would be. But there was still the stench of mutiny hanging about the cast, for her changeability had them worried, almost as much as the rehearsals not happening in the performance space did. Angela fed Peggy and the cast a line about technical issues, and she fed the crew a line about the cast needing privacy to rehearse. Opening night fell upon them, and she could no longer delay her return to the Morgan Theater. She was tempted to flee back to the stinking comfort of the city, but this was the closest she had come to a break in all her years as an artist. She imagined her name on a marquee, touring around the country with her fellows, spearheading the change she championed on stage. The thought was tantalizing, and she decided that the show would go on, ghosts and all. The ghosts were quiet for the dress rehearsal, and the generalized anxiety of having critics and producers take their reserved seats pushed those shadows even further from Angela's mind. She went on to deliver the pre-show announcements to the ecstatic roars of the largest audience she had ever seen. There was one empty seat in the very front row. It wasn't that strange for there to be empty seats at sold-out shows, but it was strange that her eye was drawn to it, and it seemed occupied by a shadow. But she pushed on, and bid the audience to enjoy the show. The play began without a hitch. The audience was laughing at the appropriate moments, gasping at others, punctuating their rapt attention with flinching and groaning. Just when the first costume element was shed, all the lights in the venue went out. A few of the audience members screamed, shocked by the sudden blackout. The actors froze, unsure how to proceed. Angela was privy to the harried radio calls from the technicians. The lights were all powered on, yet none of them were responding. There was no technical reason for this blackout. The desperate stage managers could only scream whisper into their radios and shrug, while the actors remained in their unseen vignette. The shock of the blackout wore off and the audience began to whisper amongst themselves, unsure how long to wait before applauding, debating if this was some sort of unfinished ending that was in itself a commentary on finality. When off stage, the ghost light sank into its pale blue and shone brightly enough to illuminate every corner of the stage. In spite of its brightness, Angela observed that no one was squinting to protect their eyes. Her eyes found that empty seat again, right in front, and in the blue light she could almost see his stately features, the ghost's expensive but outdated suit with a red pocket square. But she did not need the ghost light to see its eyes, which were pinpricks of red, cutting through the blue, searing into her actors. The ghost of Stuart Paunch raised its hand and all the lights came back on, all of them a sickly red that washed out the blue light entirely. But then beside her, more of an aura than a shadow, Scarlett Morgan raised her hand and fought him for control of the theater, wresting the lights from his power and restoring them to their original design. Stuart used what influence he had in the shadows to twist his nightmares out across the walls, drawing the horrors ever closer to the stage. But his nightmares, however poignant, never reached the actors, for it seemed that there was a blue edge to every single shadow the moment it touched the stage, a protection of sorts from one playwright to the next. Angela swore up and down to every word of that encounter, but she always faltered on one detail, for even she could never be sure of what she saw in the other wing. It was a white light, a true ghost, wisps of dust catching on the lights to make the features of a woman identical to Scarlett, only older, Amelia. But of that she was never sure. Though the stage was carpeted in petals when the curtain was drawn, it was not enough to save the show from the critics. They found the lighting to be compelling and mystical, but they grew tired of the show relying on shock, and found its attempted activism confusing and, frankly, exhausting. So when the show finished its four-week run at the Morgan Theater, it closed. The actors and crew returned to New York, but Angela did not. She remains at the Morgan Theater to this day, responsible for its maintenance and preservation, deciding that year's programming and running the fellowship in Peggy's name. And every night before she leaves, she brings the ghost light to center stage and wishes Scarlett a good night. That's the end of today's tale. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed telling it. Please remember to like, share, and tell all your friends. Join me next time for more fabricated folktales on Epilogue.